What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to be doing a best of today. Something bizarre, something weird, something breaking happened in the Smith household today. My teenage daughter asked me if I would come to her high school football game to see her march in the marching band, her very first performance in the marching band, and she's been working so hard. So the fact that she asked, anyone who's had teenagers knows that when there's an ask, yeah, you have to go above and beyond to fulfill. And look, I want to be there. I want to see her first performance. I want to see what she's been working hard at and what she's proud of. And so today we're on the program, going to spend a little time looking back at some of my favorite interviews. So we're going to go a politician. We're going to go Senator Day. Senator Markey from Massachusetts, Senator Doug Jones former Senator Doug Jones from Alabama, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, and Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood going to be here. Going to share some thoughts. These are interviews we've done over the past several months. Some topical stuff. Even this moment, the Supreme Court, big front and center, increasing the minimum wage, fighting for democracy. So today I thought it'd be a good idea just to take a breath, look back and go, hey, these are some really good interviews and some really good information, and I hope folks will enjoy them. I feel every time we take a day off, I feel bad. It's one of those things where, you know, fighting for democracy and fighting for better humanity. You can't take a day off. You can't take a day off from the fight for a better tomorrow. But like I said, you know, when the teenage daughter asks, you jump through. You figure it out. But, you know, this is one of those weird moments where, you know, I'm a big believer in fighting the good fight. And what's frustrating to me, and I had this weird moment recently where one of the liberal kind of think tank groups basically told me that they're never coming on the program because of the time. And I'm going, really? You know, the right, they don't know what time it is. They are willing to go everywhere. And this is where the left, I think, got a little lazy. And it triggered a memory of a former labor leader that I used to be friendly with, who told me, well, you know, we need to be more mission oriented. Now, his view was, this is why we need to break labor laws and not really adhere to, you know, those things that we advocate and we fight for. But, you know, mission driven. And I agree with mission driven 100%. But I think you can do that in a way that still respects workers' rights and still plays within the bounds. Rearranging things. Flexibility, that's there. But it's weird to me because my liberal groups, you know, they got bankers' hours, most of them. And it's one of those things where you go, you wonder why we lose most of the messaging arguments. Because our messengers, well, they got weekends off. They got bankers' hours. It's a little angering and a little frustrating, but that's just my thought. But today, as I said, taking the day to go right now, I am watching my daughter march in the band, and I got to tell you, I'm looking forward to it. So we're going to take a quick break, right back with the good senator. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. The ravages of World War II had swept across Europe. German troops had invaded Norway in April of 1940. The conditions of the Nazi occupation grew increasingly harsher. The Nazis began rationing milk, an important part of the diet of Norwegian children and workers. The rationing, however, did not apply to the German occupiers. Angered shipyard workers in Oslo walked off the job in protest. Workers from other industries joined them. 20,000 workers from 50 factories and work sites participated in the strike. The Nazi response to the uprising was predictably swift and brutal. 200 labor leaders were arrested and new Nazi chosen leaders put in their places. 27 of the arrested labor leaders and strikers were brought before a court-martial trial. Rolf Wickstrom, a welder and union steward, and Harold Viggo Hanstein, a labor lawyer, were sentenced to death for their involvement in the strike and executed. The remaining 25 strikers were convicted and sentenced to long prison sentences. Ludwig Bulin, a union railway worker, died while serving his prison sentence. So did Harry Vesely, a factory worker. Journalists were fired or arrested. Even groups like the Boy Scouts were banned. Listening to foreign broadcasts on the radio were expressly forbidden. Then radios were confiscated. In Sweden, trade unionists issued this statement in support of their fellow Scandinavian workers. They wrote, quote, "Norwegian trade unionists have fallen in the battle for Norway's freedoms and for the right of the Norwegian working class to decide for itself its own actions with the limits of Norwegian law. We honor their memory." In 1948, a memorial was placed to honor the deaths of Wickstrom and Hanstein and the workers who stood up for their country. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Mitch McConnell has come out and said that there's no secret plan in the Senate to bail out the White House. No, he said that the White House and the Speaker's teams need to sit down and settle it. Not he's not going to help on the debt ceiling, not even a little bit. And my first thought is, I don't know, if you're a U.S. senator, I mean, do you not want the country to do well? Isn't this one of those moments where you're kind of pushing both sides a little bit more than just saying, I'm doing nothing? Or is this doing something? Here to answer that question, I've asked former U.S. Senator from Alabama, Doug Jones, to come share his thoughts on the whole debt ceiling debacle. Doug, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's always great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So am I too hard on Mitch McConnell? My view is he's just making it worse. Or is this how McConnell motivates?
Well, I don't know if it's how he motivates. I mean, I've yet to figure that out with Senator Mitch. But I will say it is a complete abdication of his constitutional duties. The president of the United States at least unless there is some constitutional challenge, which may be in the works if they don't get something out. The president can't raise the debt ceiling. Only the Congress of the United States can do that. So everybody, you know, McCarthy and McConnell are putting this all on the president. But the fact of the matter is, it's their duty to get this done and get it done in a way that the president will sign it. And so I really think that Mitch is just, you know, I don't know why he feels like he can just sideline the entire Senate. That's not the way the Congress is supposed to operate. And they need to be in the middle of this. They can be very practical if they want to. But you are right about this, Rick. And that is that for anyone to basically say, I'm not going to get engaged in something that could have catastrophic consequences for the economy of the United States, catastrophic consequences for the global economy, much less the absolute full faith and credit of the United States of America, I think is shameful. I really think statements like that are shameful.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, here's the thing. And I see us in this moment, and maybe you'll agree or disagree, because I really want your thoughts on this. I look at the Freedom Caucus and many in the House, the House Republicans, as looking at this hostage situation as truly wanting to shoot the hostage. I believe there are people in the House that want to default, that want to touch the button, that want to blow this up and cause the chaos so they can blame Biden for it and a whole bunch of other ideological things. But then I see on Biden's side where you go, you got to be the adult in the room and say, look, I'm not going to deal with children who are willing to destroy the country. At some point, we've got to end this. And there's talk around the 14th Amendment and him being able to do something there. There's part of me that goes, you know, he just does that. So I want to get your thought. Is there a viable path to using the 14th Amendment to get rid of this or to set it aside to avoid this crisis? I'm curious.
Well, first of all, Rick, let me say I agree with you that there are those in the House and probably some in the Senate and Republicans across the country that would like to see this blow up. They want to see the economy tank. And that's a horrible thing to say. But I go back to 2020 and I remember specifically reading. And if you go back to the fall, spring and summer of 2020, what you saw was the beginning of inflation, the higher gas prices, and Republicans were gleeful. They were literally gleeful because you saw the president's numbers going down. You saw Democrats' chances in the midterms going down. And I remember specifically reading an article with a former member of Congress. He phrased it this way because then you had the war in Ukraine started, and all of a sudden things started turning around. People started looking at democracy more than they did inflation, and Democrats' fortunes started to turn around. And this former Republican congressman said, you know what, with inflation and higher gas prices, we had everything going for us. And then the war started. Well, everything going for us, my God, this was hurting American families. It was hurting the working men and women in this country and the children that they're trying to raise. But he was more concerned and gleeful with the prospect that the economy tanking was helping them in the midterm. That I think is there. The 14th, and so I completely agree with you on that. Look into 2024. On the 14th Amendment, I think that that's a really interesting legal concept, a legal theory that has not been tested. Yet we haven't had to test it, Rick. The debt ceiling is routinely raised. I did it two or three times when I was in the Senate. When Donald Trump was president and the Republicans controlled the Senate, you didn't hear Mitch McConnell then abdicating his responsibilities. It's been fairly routine with some bumps in the road. But the way the Constitution reads, there may be the authority of the president to simply say to the Treasury, borrow more money and pay the debts and pay our bills and let somebody challenge that. I think it's really interesting. I would not like to see that happen. What you really want to see is the Congress of the United States stepping up to do their dang job.
Absolutely. But here's the thing. I think the Republicans are so dug in, and I think McCarthy has sold his soul to be Speaker to the point to where they're going to push this as far as they have to, and to keep him in the speakership, and that being self-serving. The country, you know, be damned. Our economy be damned. Our role in the world be damned. I mean, I hear a lot of Republicans complaining about, you know, Russia and China and India and Brazil. They're going to have their own currency and they're going to be the reserve currency. Well, how about we not screw that up and give them a reason to do that?
Right. No, you're absolutely right in that. And what I'm hoping is, one, I'm hoping that they can cut some kind of deal. I'm hoping that they would do. When I say cut some kind of deal, I still think the president is right to hold out for a clean debt ceiling increase and a debt ceiling bill and say, and tell the other side, tell the Republicans that, look, if everything you want to talk about, we will talk about that in good faith during the appropriations process, because that's where it is supposed to be.
Yep.
And the president should talk to folks about that. Democrats in Congress should talk to folks about that. That's the way legislation is done, not with a gun to your head. So that's number one. The second thing that I think I'm hoping that they might do, if they can't cut some kind of deal right now, is simply to do a CR, a continuing resolution. I don't like kicking the can down the road, but in this case, it might help to kick the can down the road so that discussions in the appropriations process can be going on simultaneously with the debt ceiling discussions. They wouldn't be separate, but they would at least be going on in the same time frame and try to get it done all at once, something like that to see. Yeah. But you know, what I go back to, Rick, is this. So many of the same Republicans voted for the very debt that they say now that they don't want to pay. They voted for it. They caused a lot of it by passing the 2017 tax bill. And, you know, it's really, I just can't understand any member of Congress totally abdicating their responsibilities.
Yeah, but I get your idea of passing a continuing resolution. My problem with that is we're still using the debt ceiling as a hostage tool. We're still using that, and I don't think that's what it should be. In every American household across this country, when the credit card bill comes due, you pay it. There's no if, ands, or buts about it. When your bills come due, you got to pay your bills, or your credit rating takes a dump, and you have all of the negative consequences that come with that. I don't understand why Congress can't behave in the same fashion that they talk about every working class family in America having to deal with.
No, I agree. I totally agree with that, Rick. The only thing I'm saying is this. People are dug in, and we're living in a different world now than we've ever done. Had in terms of the polarization and the digging in and people really just going to war over things that they shouldn't be going to war over. And I'd rather see a CR like that, where they can talk on similar tracks at the same time during the appropriations process and hopefully the economy not get destroyed.
Right.
The alternative is to the for there not to be a debt ceiling raise, the economy go to hell in a handbag with apologies to your wife, and that's going to be a real problem. That's going to be a major problem, and we don't want to see that happen. We've got to figure out a way to prevent that, and that doesn't mean giving in, but you've got to make sure that if there is any way possible to avoid that kind of economic collapse, we really need to do it, because in the end, it really won't matter who caused it, because people are going to be angry at everybody.
Yeah, no, and look, and the people at the bottom are going to be the ones who suffer the most. I understand that, and I get that. But, you know, there's a point at which you got to go an adult has to step up and say this kind of ticking bomb has to stop. It's not good for our position around the world. It's not good for our economy. It's not good for working people. It's just it's something that should be abolished. Is there a way to get rid of this? Because, you know, again, I go back to, and this is the last place I want to finish on this, because there's part of me that goes, maybe if you do take this into the Supreme Court, which has been a very corporate court. You know, their decisions have come down on the side of the Chamber of Commerce much more often than not, that this would be a corporate decision to not hold the economy hostage, not screw over corporate America or working people. This could be a, and I hate using the win-win frame, but it could be one of those things where the sane people go, no, this is just bad. We should stop this.
No, I think it's a legitimate legal issue about the 14th Amendment and whether or not we can default when we've got the ability to go forward one way or another without legislation. I think that's a legitimate issue. I can't predict what the Supreme Court would do because, yes, it's been a very business-friendly court. At the same time, it has now become a very, very political court. And so if they, like I'm afraid that they have done in several cases, in the last couple of years, decided it on politics rather than on the Constitution, then we could be in trouble.
Yeah, we'll see where that goes. I'm hoping Biden does what I want him to do and say, no, we're not giving in. We're not caving. We're going to pay our bills like adults. You children sit down. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. I want to get your thoughts on this. I saw over the weekend the story coming out of New Hampshire. New Hampshire has become evidently the first state in the country to protect interracial marriage. Didn't think we had to do that. And now I see your state of Alabama, the Democrats in that state are abolishing the mandated LGBTQ caucus, the youth caucus, I guess the Hispanic caucus. What's going on? I mean, I thought this stuff was decided.
It should have been, Rick, and it is really demoralizing for Democrats in Alabama to see what the party leadership is doing. And that's what I'm saying. This is not the Democratic Party per se. This is party leadership who is just continuing to try to keep control. They are angry because we made the party more inclusive back about 4 years ago. And they didn't like it. They felt like it took away their control and their power. And it's a small group. This is not a major group, but they have influence with others. And it's really too bad. I mean, the Democratic Party in Alabama is just like it is around the country. We are should be a party with a big tent, that we're inclusive, that we celebrate the diversity. We celebrate the voices. We give opportunities for all people to participate. And what's happened in the Democratic Party of Alabama with this small group of the leadership is they've just done away with that. We spent a lot of time trying to get these caucuses into our bylaws so that we could bring in youth. I mean, Rick, but prior to 2019, when we really went to bat for the youth especially, out of the over 200 members of the state Democratic Executive Committee, there was only about 19 or 20 that were under the age of 35. Look what's happening around the country. Look what happened in Wisconsin. Look where things are headed. It is the youth of this country that are bringing the Democratic Party back. And for some reason, the Alabama Democratic Party leadership decides, they just don't know enough. We just don't care. We don't want to include, we want to be able to control them and not give them a voice. Same with the LGBTQ community, Hispanic, Asian Americans. It's really sad. A lot of people are angry about this. And so I'm hoping it will not stand.
Yeah, it's, look, there's a lot of things that I don't agree with on the extremes. But everyone should have a voice. And the Democratic Party is supposed to be that big tent wherever. So this seems to go against that ethos of, the part of the big tent party. So I thought it was interesting that coming out of your state.
Well, the irony is we Democrats have been complaining consistently over the last couple of years about efforts from the Republican Party to suppress dissenters, to cancel people like Tinkerbell when they speak out against you. We have been speaking out against Republican efforts to suppress voters, making it harder to vote, not giving people the voice. And now in Alabama, this leadership of the party has done the exact same thing with the very constituencies that are helpful to the Democratic base and helpful to the party. It is beyond something that people can understand. It's just beyond words as to why they're doing this. And it is just an old guard wanting to hang on to control and not releasing it. We see it, you know, Rick, we see this in institutions across the country. We see it in law firms and accounting firms and medical practices. When the founders of the firm and that really built the firm decide that they just don't want the younger generation coming in and telling them what to say. They would rather burn the house down. And that's what's happening in Alabama. They have decided that they are likely to burn the house down before they would relinquish control. We'll see what happens.
We'll see. Doug, I appreciate the time. Keep up the good work. I look forward to having you back again real soon.
All right, Rick. Great to be with you as always, buddy.
Thanks so much. Our good friend, former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. The talk. You're listening to the best of the Rick. You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for years, we've been talking about, you know, just how biased our Supreme Court under the leadership of Chief Justice John Roberts has become. And look, because the vast majority of decisions we know go towards the corporate, toward the moneyed interest. And I've been saying, you know, just for a long time that workers, all they want is a fair shake. We want a fair shake from our high court, and we're not getting it. So the question is, you know, with all the recent disclosures around Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, and now you've got Chief Justice Roberts saying he's not going to come and testify in front of the Senate. You know, how can working people get a fair shake when our court appears to be bought and paid for by the very wealthy? And that's why I've asked Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse to come share some thoughts with us. Senator, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So, you know, this is where my mind starts. Let's start here, Senator. I mean, average everyday working people just want their court to be fair, want to get a fair shake in front of the court. How can we have a system where, you know, our justices are being wined and dined and vacationed and flown around by the very wealthy and powerful when working people don't have that kind of access?
Well, the problem is that billionaires do have that kind of access, and they have been working it. Highly motivated billionaires, I should add, have been working it to exert control over the court in a whole variety of ways, from being in the background as that Federalist Society list was put together, to advising Trump on which judges he should pick off the list, to funding the ads for the nominees who were chosen, to sending flotillas of front groups into the court. That's what they call amici curiae, friends of the court, to write briefs telling the court what they want them to do. So the pattern of all of this overlays in a very unpleasant way with the pattern of billionaire influence and generosity and secrecy around the Thomas gifts.
Yeah. Now, you know, just not too long ago, I think it was the Center for American Progress did a study of the cases before the court. They found that whenever the Chamber of Commerce puts an amicus brief in, to your point, that they win more than 70% of the time, which is where I keep saying, you know, our court seems to be so biased on the side of the moneyed interests. And look, you know, this kind of stuff doesn't give the court any more credibility. And you would think, you know, being, you know, the high court of the land, the Supreme Court, that you would take that a little bit more seriously than what we're finding out.
I did a published report years ago that looked at the 5-4 decisions of the court, where the 5-4 broke along partisan lines. And in virtually every one of them, there was a very obvious right-wing, big Republican donor interest in the case. And so we dug in a little bit further and looked at the outcomes. And of the, I think it was 73 cases that were 5-4 partisan and had a big right-wing donor interest in, implicated, the score was 73-0.
Wow. 73-0?
73-0. Every single 5-4 partisan case with an identifiable right-wing interest in it went for the identifiable right-wing interest.
So this just goes back and solidifies my view that working people don't have a chance. Because one of the things I talk about all the time here, I fear this court is moving us back into the direction of the Lochner era, where there are no laws that can protect working people, no minimum wage laws, no maximum hour laws, no safe working condition laws, none of that stuff, that we end up back in kind of an oligarch-run country where the court is no friend to working people. So I'm listening to you say this, and man, we're steamrolling towards that.
I think the record of the court gives plenty of evidence for your thesis, and it only got worse when they went from 5-4 to 6-3, and whatever moderating effect Justice Roberts could claim to have was evaporated by him no longer being essential to a majority.
Now, that's an interesting question. What's this going to mean to the Roberts? Because Roberts is a guy that I think legacy matters to him. This is going to tarnish his legacy forever. I think this is going to be what his legacy will be, just how corrupt they appear.
Yeah, my take has been that Roberts will do whatever the big donors expect and want, up to a point where the move is so sudden, so dramatic, so drastic that it risks damaging the reputation of the court. Thomas and Alito are just like him up to that last point, but they don't care very much about the reputation of the court. They just want to get the job done for the donors that put him there.
What do you say? What do you say, Senator? I had a bunch of people tell me that the whole system's corrupt. It's all bad. This isn't just them. I'm making much ado about nothing. How much of that of this is? You know, this is just how the game has always been played. Are we taking this in the wrong direction?
Well, I would say, first of all, I think dark money has completely rotted out Congress on issues that are important to the big dark money donors. So there are issues in which, you know, I think some general skepticism about Congress and politics is appropriate. And the problem with that is that, yeah, members of Congress have been corrupt forever. Special interests have had improper influence forever. But the court has usually been exempt from that. The court has often been a check on that kind of behavior. And what you've seen recently from the Roberts Court is they've completely thrown in with the anti-democratic, oligarchic, Republican, big money forces in case after case after case. And that's what's discouraging to me, because the court's supposed to be the place where you get a fair shake. And also, the court's really hard to repair if it's gone bad, because it's protected from political influence without any exemption for political influence that's designed to clean the place up.
Right. Now, do you have any faith in John Roberts that he's going to conduct an investigation and that we get to the bottom or any resolution to this? Because I don't. I look at what happened with the Alito leaked document. I have very little faith in this institution, and I think a lot of working people share my skepticism. Do you have any faith that he'll do it? And if he doesn't, you as part of the Judiciary Committee, what are you guys going to do?
I asked him to undertake an investigation of the Thomas incident, and he referred it to the Judicial Conference, which is other federal judges. He's the only Supreme Court justice in the group, who then referred it to their Financial Disclosure Committee. And what's weird about that is that 11 years ago, a similar set of concerns were raised about gifts by Harlan Crow of yacht travel and jet travel to Justice Thomas. And they went also to the Judicial Conference and from it to the Financial Disclosure Committee. And we have so far been able to determine no sign of there ever having been any outcome or decision.
So what you're telling me is don't have any faith in whatever investigation comes out of this. So which means that you as a legislator.
We need to look at that. We need to find out what happened. And if this is going to be if nothing happened and the investigation just got buried in the Financial Disclosure Committee, and now the second investigation has gone to the same place, then we need an understanding of how that works, what goes on, and who's pulling strings.
Now, I understand you guys are going to have a hearing on June 2nd that Roberts was invited
May
to.
May 2nd, yeah.
What are we expecting to come out of this? What are we hoping for?
Well, Roberts has declined to attend, so we have a panel of experts on judicial ethics who will come in and share their views. I expect what is likely to come out of it is the obvious. They will confirm that if you have a code of judicial ethics and a bunch of ethics statutes that the justices are nominally bound by, but there's no ref to blow the whistle if they break the rules, they're going to figure that out pretty soon, and they're going to come up with some pretty eccentric views of what the rules and the statutes say, and it's very hard to work through that problem. And that will help build the case, I think, for a statutory code of ethics for the Supreme Court with a statutory method of inquiry, examination, determination, and enforcement.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. If you want to check out his website, we'll get links out at the social media how you can do that. I got a question. Ed Markey, senator from Massachusetts, called for Thomas's resignation. Are we on board with that? I mean, is there any way that this, you know, rises to the level of him being ousted? Because I got a lot of my left friends going, you know, we need to impeach, we need to do all this thing, he's going to go. I don't see that happening, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I'm trying to operate in the world of the possible, given that we have a House controlled by the Republicans who are in turn controlled by the same donors who put these judges on the court. So there's not going to be an impeachment under Speaker McCarthy. And, you know, we couldn't get votes to convict on an impeachment against Donald Trump after all he did, set aside Clarence Thomas over this. So I don't think whether it's merited is a separate question. Impeachment is simply not feasible. I think that the way we're going to make progress here is by continuing to put a harsh spotlight on the uniquely peculiar misbehavior of the Supreme Court and provoke the other federal judges who are not on the Supreme Court, who have to abide by the code of ethics, who are subject to investigation and review if there are allegations against them, to get them to the point where they say, okay, enough, you guys, we're not going to put up with this any longer. And the pressure will come from inside the judiciary.
So you think they're going to police themselves? I'm not a big fan of policing themselves. I think there has to be some legislation. If they're not going to oversee themselves and be able to do it, there's got to be something that puts them in this place, which is, you know, brings us to the legislation that you're moving on.
I've got the bill for that.
The Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act, SCERT Act. I don't know why we don't already have something like this in place, but tell me about it.
Well, we've always trusted the Supreme Court to police itself, and there have not been instances of misbehavior of this variety in memory. Justice Fortas was involved in far less troubling circumstances and resigned from the court. But these guys don't want to resign. They're on a mission, so we have to deal with them. And the bill would set up they'd have to adopt a code of ethics. They'd have to set up rules of procedure for having themselves investigated by investigators and by, like staff attorneys who do it in the lower courts. There'd have to be a determination. Other judges would make the determination, so it stays within the judicial branch. And then they'd also have to clean up with respect to gifts and hospitality. They'd have to clean up about recusing themselves from cases, and they'd have to require better disclosure of these amici curiae, the friend of the court briefs, where the billionaires send in front groups who they funded to tell the judges what to do, and the justices, I should say, and the justices don't bother to inquire who's funding the front groups. They just allow this whole charade to continue.
Yeah, for me, you're going through this again, and it all comes back down to the money, doesn't it? It comes back down to all of this money that we've given a handful of people, which I then come back to where I'm usually at on these issues, is it's time we start taxing these people and using that money in a much more productive way to ensure that not just our institutions are sound, but our country's sound. It just sounds like this is a tax the rich moment for me as well.
Yeah, and, you know, the role of huge amounts of money in all this. I've described it as a noxious cocktail of creepy billionaires, phony front groups, dark money millions, amenable justices, and secrecy. That is not a good combination really anywhere, and it's certainly not a good combination in a court. And the problem is that a vicious cycle has developed in which those forces take over the court, and then the court supports creepy billionaires, phony front groups, dark money millionaires, and secrecy. And that cycle has to be broken and reversed.
See, for me, this is a moment where, you know, I don't care which hat you've got on. I don't care if it's a red hat or a blue hat. I'm going to steal Rupert Murdoch's line. It's not about red or blue. It's about green. This is something that should unite all of us across party lines, because having a Supreme Court that is, well, less than supreme and not above suspicion of impropriety is not good for the country. This should be something universally across party lines. We want to make sure that is cleaned up and, you know, made, I guess, you know, wholesome again.
Yeah. And I think it's a tell when it's not just elected politicians talking about it, but when it becomes more of a topic among other judges. And what I'm hearing is that it has become a topic among other judges, and they're really quite sick of what they're being obliged to have to swallow from the Supreme Court.
Because it makes them look bad, too, I would think. I mean, it makes
exactly
the whole system look bad.
Yeah, it makes the whole system look bad, particularly when the excuse of the Supreme Court is, oh, we're not breaking any rules here. This is the way the rules are. We're living within them. And regular judges look at that and say, that's ridiculous. That is completely not true. If you were actually subject to enforcement of the rules, you'd know that wasn't true, because we couldn't get away with this. There aren't circuit court of appeals judges taking $500,000 vacations from billionaires. They aren't circuit court of appeals judges rigging the rules so that they can ask the owner of a resort for a vacation and then take it and keep it secret as personal hospitality because the owner of the resort invited them personally, even if they don't know the person. You know, stuff like that, there's just no way that's credible in any other court.
No, and here's the thing, and maybe it's just because I'm getting older. I'm old enough to remember when this was wrong. I'm old enough to remember when this would have been something that would have outraged everyone until someone had to resign. I'm old enough to remember.
Like Fortas did.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember that this is something that we shouldn't want, and not something that's based on politics, right or left, but right or wrong. And this is wrong to me. It smells of wrong in every way. So the last line of questioning I've got for you is, you know, how do we pull people around to remembering that this is wrong? Take off the red hat. Take off the blue hat. This is about the green, to steal from Rupert.
Yeah, I think constant exposure to the facts of what is going on is really important. I think Roberts and the Federal Society of Justices on the court are hoping for the next big news cycle to blow this away, and they can go back to previous ways of doing business. The last episode in which Clarence Thomas didn't report his wife's income from the right-wing front group, the Heritage Foundation, was back in 2011. And here we are in 2022.
Yeah.
Back then, he was accused of taking gifts of yacht travel and jet travel from Harlan Crow. Here we are in 2022 having to relive it. So I think this time we just need to stick with it and make sure we don't let it get away from us and keep the pressure on and hope and pray that either a glimmer of conscience in Chief Justice Roberts, or pressure from the rest of the bench gets a cleanup.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this is where we'll finish this. You know, average working people like me, average people listening to this program know that if you lie on a form, there's consequences. If you do the kind of things that he's being accused of, there are consequences. And sadly, there will be no consequences for Clarence Thomas other than a black check on his record down the line. That's what I think. That's what infuriates me, Senator.
Yeah. Well, I think for a lot of people who are state and local employees as well, I was on a phone call and a caller said that she was, a state employee, maybe a local municipal employee in West Virginia. And she had to report when she went out someplace and they served lunch and it was like a $5 lunch. And she had to go through all these, you know, reports about the $5 lunch that she got. And, you know, here's a guy who's taking yacht trips and jet plane, private jet trips, and having his mom put up rent free in a house that a billionaire owns. The whole thing is just unacceptable to regular people.
I'm right there with you. Senator, I appreciate the time. I look forward to the hearing on the 2nd. I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on how this is going down the road.
Will do. Gladly, Rick. Thanks for the attention to this.
Thank you so much, Senator. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, whitehouse.senate.gov, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that he's doing. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1975. That was the day the AFL-CIO held a Jobs Now rally in Washington, D.C. A painful recession had pushed unemployment in the U.S. to 9%. Many workers across the nation thought the Ford administration was not doing enough to address the needs of working families. 60,000 people, many of them union members carrying banners representing their unions, gathered in RFK Stadium. There they heard speeches, including one from Senator Hubert H. Humphrey, who had served as vice president under Lyndon B. Johnson. His speech described the devastating impact of unemployment. Senator Humphrey said, "Our nation must recommit itself to the goal and the promise of full employment, a job for every American who is willing and able to work. Perhaps we would get bolder action and more compassion from this administration if some of its top advisors had a little taste of unemployment themselves. Perhaps they would know what unemployment is. It's drawing your last unemployment check with no job in sight. It's sitting in the dark to save on the light bill. It's making shoes last another month and driving on bald tires. It's eating a little less so the kids can eat a little more. It's facing eviction because you can't pay the rent or meet the mortgage. It's borrowing from your brother-in-law or letting your insurance lapse. It's facing yourself in the mirror and asking why and how much longer. It's wondering how a nation this rich, this enterprising, this great can let more than 8 million Americans who want to work and need to work go without work." Some protesters rushed the stage at the rally, causing it to end early. But his questions still remain. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, I look at this, and the angering part of all this is they do it out in public, right out in front of us. And I've been screaming about this for years. I mean, Senator Whitehouse brought up the fact that, you know, back in 2011, it was on 60 Minutes, actually, that Clarence Thomas was talking about all the gifts that he had gotten and all, you know, driving his big RV and the money for Ginny to go work at the Heritage Foundation and do all the Tea Party stuff she did. Because, hey, you know, access to a sitting U.S. Supreme Court justice gets you kind of a high-paying gig. But it's even more than that. I mean, it's not just Thomas. Understand. It's all of them. It was. What did the One Times report say? Scalia took more than 250 subsidized trips. In fact, the one he died on, where he died, he was on one of these subsidized trips. He was on a hunting ranch owned by some guy named Poindexter. And you go, why? Now, Scalia used to whine all the time that he believed he was underpaid. But I guess you throw in the perks, you know. Stephen Breyer, they say, took more than 225 subsidized trips from 2004 to 2018. And look, the numbers are all there. This isn't, it's what they've been doing for a while. But it's gotten really just completely out of hand. And one of the things that the Times pointed out is that they hold these black tie events and they trot these justices around and, you know, to get access to them. And they hold an annual black tie dinner where the ticket is at least $5,000 to get in. How many working people got $5,000 to go to a rubber chicken dinner? How many? None that I know of. These are the rich and powerful. These are the special interests that we now have a historical court, a Supreme Court historical society that raised last year, according to the Times, $6.4 million. From special interests and groups that have business in front of the court. Because why else would you go other than to get that 5 minutes to talk with the justice? You know, hey, you know, my guy. I go back to what I said before. I've had friends who have served in Congress. They all tell me the same thing. No one's ever bought my vote. But they buy my ear 15 minutes at a time to lobby their issue. So when I call them and ask for money, they go, yeah, I'll give you money, but I got this problem. And to get the money, you got to listen to the problem. And eventually you come around to their way of thinking. Because if you don't help them with their problem, guess what happens? No more money. And this is where money in politics is the problem. And the sooner that we wake up to that reality and rein that in, especially from all of these right-wing think tanks and these front groups, and look, there's a little bit of that on the left too. I'm not naive to that fact, but the right does it so much better. The corporate interests do it so much better because they've got so much more money. I know George Soros, but for every George Soros, there's 20 right-wing billionaires who are funding, you know, for the love of dogs and puppies. And it's got to stop. That's why I'm glad to see someone like Sheldon Whitehouse out there fighting the good fight. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Tuesday, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey and Georgia Congressman Hank Johnson held a press conference to announce legislation to expand the Supreme Court from the current 9 to 13. The idea being the stated goal, restore legitimacy to the court. Can you believe we have to talk about this in this day and age? But here we are. Senator Markey highlighted what he said was head-spinning hypocrisy and called for undoing Republican thievery. Hit a chord with me when he said, hey, don't agonize, organize. Don't get mad, get to work. And that's why we've asked Senator Markey to come share some thoughts with us on how maybe we move this forward. Senator, thanks for taking time for us.
I love being with you. Thank you.
So this is not a new concept. It's happened some 86 years ago. What are the chances this legislation is going to move and we're going to actually get some sanity into the court? What are the chances of this getting through?
It's inevitable that it's going to move. And thank you for saying it's happened before. Originally, the Supreme Court only had 6 members on it. It's determined by Congress, not by the Constitution. And Abe Lincoln actually expanded it to 10 seats. Then it got reduced down to 9 seats, which is where it has been. So it's not 9 forever etched into the United States Constitution. This is different. And what's happening, obviously, is that we're living right now in the aftermath of a political heist of 2 Supreme Court seats by Mitch McConnell and by Donald Trump. When Antonin Scalia passed away, they developed a new policy saying, oh my goodness, we cannot confirm a new Supreme Court justice during a presidential year. So they kept the seat vacant for 130 days. Unbelievable. It was like eight seats for 430 days, so that they could then put Gorsuch on after Trump won. Then this sacred doctrine goes right into the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So she passes away, and all of a sudden, in 30 days, right before the Trump reelection in 2020, they can confirm Amy Coney Barrett. 30 days, not 430 days.
Right.
So that's hypocrisy on stilts, and they swiped the two seats. Well, what are the consequences? Well, the repeal of Roe versus Wade, reducing safety measures for gun laws, and ultimately all union rights will be on the table, as will health, as will safety laws. They're all going to be now on the table for a radical right-wing 6-3 majority in the Supreme Court. And what we need to do in order to rectify this heist is to increase the number of justices by 4 up to 13, and then that will restore the balance that otherwise would have existed if the Republicans had not stolen those seats. It would be 7-6, and then we can begin to restore precedent, restore some semblance of respect for what our country has become, and not this crazy nostalgia for a time that never existed that this Supreme Court majority now seeks to impose upon us, something from 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago. And ultimately, I believe that every session of the Supreme Court, coming up, by the way, just in June of this year, they're gonna basically make 5 or 6 decisions that are gonna outrage the American people.
Right.
Then next June, they're going to do the same thing, and it's all going to build towards more and more members of the House and Senate signing on to the bill to expand the court and putting it on the ballot for 2024 as a big issue that all Americans are going to have to reckon with as they're going into the ballot box.
Yeah, I think it's important, as you pointed out, there are a lot of big things that get the attention. And when I talk to my conservative friends, you go, yeah, okay, fine, you're against the abortion rights. But all of these other things, all of this corporate stuff, the Roberts Court, in my view, probably the most corporate court in the history of our country. I saw a thing the other day that said when the Chamber of Commerce puts in a brief on any case, they win almost more than 3/4 of the time, upwards of 80% of the time they win. You said union rights are on the chopping table, safe working conditions, all of this stuff that applies to working people every day that never gets the headlines. And I think that's stuff that has to be pointed out as well. The entire 20th century is on the chopping block.
Every single worker safety, job protection, union protection law is going to be on the table. They now have a home court advantage, a home Supreme Court advantage, and they're going to win every single time. Corporate America.
Well, what do you say to this?
Undermine those rights.
What do you say to the argument? Look, you know, Senator, you know, the Republicans just played the game better. They out-organized, they out-funded, they for decades have funded right-wing think tanks and media outlets and, the Federalist Society. They've got the infrastructure to build this juggernaut. They've just done it better. What do you say to that argument?
I say that we've got to do it better ourselves. That's why we have to expand the court. Now, people say, well, that is unseemly. We shouldn't do that. My answer is, when bullies steal your lunch money down the schoolyard, if you don't do anything about it, they're going to come back over and over and over again stealing your lunch money. So we've got to fight back. And the way to fight back, the way to stand up to bullies is to expand the court, to take back control that legitimately belongs in democratic hands.
Now, what's interesting to me, and I had a conversation a couple of years ago with a conservative who told me, actually it was the night that Trump was elected, said it's going to be interesting watching liberals become states' rights people and people learning just how important the Supreme Court is. And this was well before a lot of this stuff was in the headlines. And you look today, the anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. You go in a couple of weeks, you're going to have the Loving anniversary of the Loving decision. All of this stuff that we take for granted, that's popular in the public, that people want, this court could conceivably overturn in the coming years, as you know, weeks, months, and years, as you pointed out.
We went 100 years after the Civil War thinking we had a 14th Amendment, a 15th Amendment. Thinking that we had a right to vote for all blacks in our country. Didn't happen. It took Martin Luther King Jr., took people like Thurgood Marshall being put on the Supreme Court, who was the lead lawyer in Brown versus Board of Education, by the way, in 1953, in order to begin to implement what the promise was of the Civil War in terms of protecting the rights of minorities in our country. That's something that really sticks in the craw of these very conservative, especially red state Republicans who want to go back to a time before the civil rights movement. And so, if we're not going to fight, then we're going to betray the legacy of all of those who stood up in the 50s and 60s in order to expand procedural and substantive due process in our country. And so that's our challenge right now, generationally. We're up. It's our time. We have to fight the same way that those great leaders in the 60s fought.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Senator Ed Markey. You want to check out his website, markey.senate.gov. We'll get links out on social media, how you can do that, and maybe get involved in pushing. Don't be agonizing, organizing. It's what we need to be doing. Now, here's the thing. You've been in the Senate for a number of years. You've been in government for quite a number of years. We keep hearing this word conservative being thrown out. These are not my grandparents' conservatives. These folks right now are radicals who want to completely change the face of this country into a corporatocracy or an oligarchy, however you want to frame that. And I think it's important that we start calling this kind of stuff out in very loud ways.
Exactly right. Conservative really means, in the traditional sense, that you respect precedent. You respect what has happened in the past. All we have to look at is the Dobbs decision. You're repealing Roe versus Wade. That was a 49-year-old precedent that our country had come to accept as the law of the land. But Alito, all of them, they really don't care. It was pre-packaged. They were going to repeal it. And there's a lot more that they're going to repeal as well. It's on the agenda, actually. Justice Thomas, in his concurring opinion with Alito on the Dobbs decision, said that, yeah, we should also be talking about contraception and access to contraception as well. It's just crazy. It wants to go back to 1958, wants to go back to a time before all of these rights had been kind of enshrined into our constitutional framework by the courts of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and on. So it's a historic challenge. There's never been a time like this. It's an illegitimate Supreme Court. The Federalist Society has handpicked these judges, and they're going to go systematically through every single area of American life, pull up a case from below, most likely from southern states, from Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, and then they're going to rule 6-3 to repeal a statute under which we've lived for generations.
You brought up Clarence Thomas. The joke has always been, and for years of the Roberts Court, that they're bought and paid for by big moneyed interest. We're now finally seeing in public that, I guess what I've learned from Clarence Thomas is I've got the wrong friends. I've never had anyone buy me real estate or take me on, you know, $500,000 vacations or pay my kids tuition. This to me is a real problem that is still not being addressed. Is there a way forward on holding these justices accountable, even while we're talking about expanding the court?
Well, I believe that Justice Thomas should resign, obviously. And I believe that there should be an adoption of a real code of conduct on the Supreme Court. And if they don't, I believe that Congress should impose a code of conduct on them.
Here's the thing, Senator. Here's my problem. This idea that I didn't know how to fill out the form, or I was told I didn't have to. If I fill out a government form improperly, if I, you know, make these statements, bad things happen to me. And, look, I'm not a Supreme Court justice. But saying that the forms, well, were seems like a reach to me, where the average everyday working person is going, hey, there'd be consequences for me if I did this, probably going to jail. Why doesn't it apply to someone like Thomas?
Precisely. So we are, thanks to Justice Thomas and his wife, Jeannie Thomas, we're in that discussion, really a needed discussion in our country. And I think that we can give them, you know, the opportunity to put together their own code of conduct at all of the federal judiciary levels below the Supreme Court. There is a code of conduct. And if they don't, I think it's time for us to have that debate.
No, and the other part of this is, I'm sure you saw the CNN Trump thing that was happened the other day at the town hall, where Trump came out and admitted, hey, that Roe thing, I did that. I'm the one who overturned Roe because I got you three justices. Is there a moment where we go, you know, all three of those people came and perjured themselves in front of the Senate? Because I got to assume that they made it for Trump to make that kind of claim. He had to have assurances that these folks were on the right page.
Well, look, at people think that Supreme Court justices serve for life, but actually they serve for good behavior. The problem is, to remove a justice would require, you know, 2/3 most likely of the Senate in order to accomplish that goal. At this particular point in time, that's not going to be possible. Yeah. What will be possible is for us to inject all of these issues into the 2024 election cycle, so that everything is on the table and the Supreme Court will be the ultimate arbiter of whether or not those rights, those protections for all Americans and all aspects of their lives are protected. Especially, my father was a union guy. My father was a local vice president of an electrical union. He used to hold up his finger that got cut off when he was a young man working in a factory, and he'd go, Eddie, that was before OSHA, you know, that was before OSHA. Then he'd have another finger that he'd use in order to describe how he felt about pre-OSHA, pre-labor protections that were put on the books. All of it, all those safety laws, all those wage protections, all of those, you know, are all going to be on the table at the Supreme Court. So we can't, as you said, we can't agonize. We have to organize.
Yes, sir. You know, reminds me of an interesting story. Last summer, we did a Working Class Heroes radio tour, and we were up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and we went to one of the coal mine tours. And the guy was talking about the working conditions there and how, you know, they were working in knee deep of muck and feces and horrible stuff. And the conditions were just deplorable. And a woman behind me goes, where was OSHA? Because we've become so accustomed to having these things that people never understood or never dawned on her that there was a before OSHA, which I found very interesting. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because on the labor rights front is where I spend most of my time. I've been saying since Roberts came around that their goal is to take us back to the Lochner era, to where if you're desperate enough and hungry enough to work for poverty wages, if you're in deplorable conditions, hey, that's your freedom. That's your liberty to go and do. And I see incrementally us moving back that way. Janus took, you know, union rights away from the public sector workers. Concepcion did the whole forced arbitration stuff. There's case after case after case going against working people. I don't know that we spend enough time talking about that. I think that's something we should be really highlighting more.
My father always would say, Eddie, you can't beg for your rights. You got to take them. You got to fight for them. So everyone should understand it's all on the table with the Supreme Court. Every June from now until we expand the court are going to be ripping away these rights, yeah, these protections.
So what do we do? What's the marching order? What do we do tomorrow? What do we do right now?
We need a Democratic House. We need a Democratic Senate. We need to keep Joe Biden in. Then we need to expand the court. We can do it if we construct that. And so that means 2024 decision time. Because this illegitimate far right wing Supreme Court is aiming at every one of these rights and protections. And because it's corporations that created this entire Heritage Foundation, Leonard Leo world out there, they're principally aiming at the protections which workers have received from corporations over the years through legislation or through court decisions. So it's all on the line. And I just hope that your listeners understand this. This is the moment, the existential moment. We have to keep Joe Biden. We got to get back 4-5 more seats in the House, hold on to the Senate, and then let's just do what needs to be done. We cannot allow the bullies to continue to take our lunch money. We got to fight with the same intensity, the same passion that they do. And your listeners are those people. They are the workers. They are the fighters. They are the people who know that the unions built the middle class in our country. And right now, the Supreme Court is intent on taking away all of those protections, all of those guarantees that have been put on the books over all of these past decades.
Senator, I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts with us down the line. And best of luck getting this through, something we desperately need. Thanks so much.
Love being with you. Thank you. Thanks for what you do.
Senator Ed Markey. Check out that website, markey.senate.gov. We'll get links out on social media. I can do that. Can take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I want to get to a couple of quick emails. Carl, listening on KTNF in Minneapolis, says, Rick, I didn't hear you once mention Carl Clarence Thomas and all of the ethical scandals he is involved in. Doesn't this alone render the court illegitimate? And look, as I said, you know, if it were any one of us, if it were you, if it were me, if we screwed up these forms, if we just said, you know, hey, someone told me I didn't have to, they'd feed and house and clothe us. That's what they would do. The reward for doing that would be a residence. It'd be small, cramped. You'd probably have a roommate, but you know, you three hots and a cot. There's no chance Thomas is going to be held accountable for all of the stuff that he's done. And I don't know what reasonable person looks at what Clarence Thomas did and say, oh, that's okay. I don't know that how he can justify it. Understand, you know, I don't know how you go, yeah, I took a $500,000 vacation because he's my buddy. He's my friend. He you know, lets me use his yacht whenever. You know, it's kind of like your neighbor letting you use the yard rake. Same thing, you know, multi-million dollar yachts, you know, leaf blower, same thing. You know, it's just how it is. But then again, my neighbor never paid for my kids' tuition either. Never bought real estate to improve. I mean, there's so much here that you go, how could anybody look at what Thomas has done and not say he's got to go? And his wife is a whole nother monster story. The hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that have been funneled to her from these right-wing groups. I know. As I've been told, it's this incestuous pool in which they live. They're not buying their access. They're treating their friends well. They're good friends. They want to see their friends do well. Now, look, the Supreme Court situation we're in, you can thank the organization. And I keep coming back to this, and Senator Markey brought it up too. Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society and the organizing that conservatives have been doing, big moneyed interests have been doing for decades. And from high school, from you know, first year in college, all the way through law school, creating an environment where they're grooming the next justices. The next people who are going to sit on the bench. It's all about feeding. It's all about feeding them. And very, very well. I guess, you know, look, who could turn down a $500,000 vacation? I had someone ask me, would you turn it down? I'm like, no, of course not. What, am I an idiot? But there's a difference between me, a guy sitting behind a microphone on the radio, and a sitting U.S. Supreme Court justice who has the hopes, the dreams, the legitimacy, the faith of 350 some million people. And he's betrayed them. Seems simple. Brian also sent me an email, said public trust in the institution of the Supreme Court has been plummeting. Combine their decisions on voting rights, money, and politics, and then taking away Roe with the attempted insurrection and Trump saying he's going to pardon the insurrectionists if reelected. This feels like it's an aspect of a larger slide towards extremism in this country. Do you think? We've been seeing this kind of extremism. You know, if you go back to 92 and you go, you know, Pat Buchanan's speeches were better in their original German, that was kind of a slide away from, you know, conservative thought of the day. We have jumped the shark again and again and again. This is like a hurdling of the sharks of how far this Republican Party has gone from even the Buchanan era. So this idea that the court has legitimacy left, sorry, I'm not buying it. So how do we save it? A conservative would tell me, got to kill it. That's what my conservative friends say. You got to kill it to save it, much like the argument about Social Security. The only way we can save Social Security is if we change everything about it. Destroy it all. What do you think? I got to tell you, I don't have great hope for this court. And unless we get our heads collectively around the idea that elections matter, because I remember the 2016 election. I remember walking the line of voters ready to vote and having conservative after crazy MAGA hat wearing nutcase tell me it's all about the Supreme Court. Don't care about any of Trump's problems. It's all about the Supreme Court. Why? Because they knew. They had been trained by right-wing media to understand the court is where the power is. Changing the laws to justify your crimes, that's where the power is. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news coming out of the Pennsylvania State House. They recently passed a minimum wage increase, 103 to 100. Actually got a couple of Republicans to come over and say, yeah, maybe working people do need an increase in their wages. The minimum wage will go up to $15 an hour in 2026. As I understand, this is going to peg to inflation, so we won't have a decade plus of the minimum wage being eroded by inflation. Also, the tipped minimum wage going to be 60% of the minimum wage, also to be pegged to inflation. This is important. And it passed the House. Good thing. Now, is it going to get through the Senate? I'm here to share some thoughts on if it's possible to get this bill through the Pennsylvania State Senate. I've asked Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood to come give us some thoughts. Art, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for allowing me on. Yeah, we got a tremendous opportunity to raise the wage in Pennsylvania based upon what the House has passed.
And what do you think the chances of that are going to be, given the fact that Republicans overwhelmingly control the state Senate?
So it is an uphill battle, but a couple of things are in our favor. Number one, State Senator Dan Laughlin, Republican from Erie, has proposed a similar bill, not exactly the same, but similar, getting it to 15. So I think that's good news for us. The second piece of good news is that we have 2-1 those who want to see it. We've got the governor who wants to see it go up. We've got the House that wants to see it go up, and those are advantages. Now, there are negotiations ongoing now, and as a result of those negotiations, there's no outcome yet. One thing I will say that I see is a challenge around the Commonwealth that, let me describe it as follows. So we know that Pennsylvania is the last in the nation in terms of the wage rate. We know we're surrounded by states with a higher wage. It's up to 14 in New Jersey, getting ready to hit 15, same in New York. On the other hand, West Virginia's at 8.75, Ohio's at 10.10. And so those in the West are looking to Ohio and West Virginia for a standard. those in the East are looking for New Jersey and New York. So we've got a big tension here that I hope we can favorably resolve.
Now, once the House passed this increase, and look, I'm 100% behind it, immediately all the naysayer groups, the Commonwealth Foundations and the employment opportunity groups and all of them were immediately out saying, this is going to cost us jobs, Art. We're going to lose thousands of jobs. It's going to be those tip jobs, those restaurant jobs, those service. They're going to all be gone, Art. It's going to be the end of public sector work.
Yeah, we hear these myths over and over again. And what I tell people to do is, first of all, just look to New Jersey. Just look to New York. These are all states that are going to 14 an hour. These are all states where there's no reports of jobs lost, folks are not getting paid anymore. And so while there's all these theories about what might happen, there is a reality of what happened. And that is in New York, that is in New Jersey, all the states that surround us. There's no job losses being reported. I want to share one other thing. Raising the minimum wage is really good for businesses. And it's primarily so because low-paid workers will get the money and typically spend it in the neighborhood where they live and work. I say to people, business owners, would you rather have someone come to your store with $100 to spend or $200 to spend? All business owners said they would rather have people with $200. So doubling the minimum wage will create exactly that result, doubling the amount of money that consumers have to spend, and that is really good for business.
But, you know, again, it comes back down to this idea, which side are you on? Are you on the side of the people who work for a living, or the side of the corporate interests who put, it's all about putting more profit into their pockets? But we hear all the time that this caring for the small business owner, we care about the mom and pops. You know, can you speak to a little bit to this? Because, look, I look at a lot of the low-wage jobs. These are big corporations. These are people who are, the fast food industry. You see a lot of the wages being suppressed. Can you speak a little bit to what this would do to the mom and pops in your view?
Sure. And I also want to share that often the big businesses try to hide behind the very small businesses and pretend that they are going to have the same level of suffering or challenges at small business. And we know that's not the case for any of these national, multinational companies. They can afford it. Second thing is, across Pennsylvania, wages have been going up for small, medium, and large businesses. This is because of the competition. And so now some businesses are paying $16, $17 an hour. And unfortunately, though, some individuals have been left behind, which is exactly why we got to raise the minimum wage. Let me go straight to the point of the mom and pops. So small businesses in New Jersey, mom and pops in New Jersey, surviving. Mom and pops in New York, surviving. Mom and pops in Ohio, surviving. So all of these small businesses that are rightly concerned about this change can look to where the wage has raised and see the experience. And more money that people have to spend. This is an easy equation. The more people that have to spend, the better it is for small businesses, mom and pops, big business, middle-sized businesses. So the increased income from sales should have a big benefit. The second big benefit that we often repeat is turnover. And small businesses, mom and pop businesses, often have a lot of turnover because of the wages that they're paying. What has been consistently found is that a higher minimum wage helps to reduce turnover. And turnover is a cost to all businesses, big and small.
It sounds like there are a lot of really good reasons to raise the minimum wage. But all I keep getting from my friends on the other side is the fear. We're going to lose jobs. And can you talk a little bit to the studies that may have been done in places like, Seattle, where they have raised the minimum wage, and what effect that had on, because it's my understanding that when you raise the minimum wage, there's actually a slight increase in the number of jobs that are produced instead of the doomsday that's been thrown around that we're going to lose a quarter of all restaurant jobs because of this. Can you share a little bit on that?
Yeah, no, there have been a number of studies, and Seattle is one of the places which has been studied a lot because they went to $15 more quickly than any other place. And what was discovered from the Seattle study is, A, there was no job loss. B, there was some job gain. This job gain is very fundamental. The more money people have to spend, the better it is for the economy, the more the economy grows because there's more sales. And that is the most fundamental economic approach that is out there. People spend money. You have to produce more to respond to demand of what people are buying, and that grows the economy, grows jobs.
Yep.
So that's the most simple explanation I can give the people.
Sounds like common sense.
In terms of why it happens.
No, I mean, it sounds like common sense. I mean, the reality is the more money working people have in their pockets, the more they're going to spend, and the more that business is going to work to get that money. It seems like a positive direction. It seems like, you know, a growing economy as opposed to we're going to restrain how much money people have in their pockets and you know, make them struggle and suffer and not be able to afford the things they need. It just seems like common sense.
Yeah, it's most often that's right, Rick. It's most often called the virtuous circle, which is the more money individuals, working people have to have, then it pumps more money into the economy. And that is the virtuous circle that we get when we make sure everyday people have a decent standard of living. That's on which the economy is based.
There you go. I hope folks will in Pennsylvania and our Pennsylvania audience reach out to your state senator, say we need to get this done. We need to get it done soon. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood. You know, Art, I saw the House has passed a couple other pieces of legislation I wanted to get your thoughts on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in this country, medical debt is a huge thing. In fact, you know, someone sent me a graph of, you know, the number of people who have to file bankruptcy every year because of medical debt, and it was some obscene number, like, you know, 700,000 people a year. Whereas in other countries, you know, like Britain, France, Japan, Germany, nobody files because of medical debt because they have a national healthcare system. I understand our House has passed something that would help prevent and help provide relief from people with medical debt. I'm curious your thoughts, if you have any thoughts on House Bill 78.
Yeah, I think it's the right direction in which to head. The Affordable Care Act from Obamacare was also in response to the high level of bankruptcies that individuals are having to endure because of medical debt and medical bills. So this is going, in my opinion, it's going in exactly the right direction to relieve individuals from some of these high costs from hospitals and physician care. Now, I will say in terms of prospects in the Senate, I think that's going to be a little more challenging, at least to get it done quickly, because we haven't had really any hearings on it or a whole lot of discussion on it. So it may take the Senate more time to get comfortable with this kind of relief. But this is the right direction. This is a kind of reasonable relief that people deserve.
I'm there. And this is one of the reasons I bring this up, and I know this is going to be a heavy lift to get past the Senate. Just like I know that the House Bill 1050 to keep preventative care free in health care plans here in Pennsylvania, probably going to be a heavy lift in the Senate. I think these are important campaign issues. I think these are important issues to bring to people and say, look, which side are you on? And then which side are your elected officials on? Because, you know, for too long, we've been letting people off the hook. You know, families are struggling. Families are having a hard time with health care, with education. You go through the struggles, and I think we have to show which side people are on.
Yeah, and I think that is exactly what the House Democrats are doing, and we will do as well. They are demonstrating consistently that they are on the side of everyday people, on the side of everyday people with respect to pay, on the side of everyday people with respect to health care bills. They also passed legislation I started in the Senate to increase the ability of people to save for retirement with automatic payroll deduction. These are all bills directly related to improving the everyday life of Pennsylvanians. And there is a tremendous contrast because the Senate does not yet appear to make to be willing to do so. Now, I say not yet because we're not done, but if the Senate doesn't align with these important initiatives, we will know where they stand.
Yep. Last question I've got for you. Being from the Philly area, pretty incredible work done on the I-95 bridge. I got to give Governor Shapiro an enormous amount of credit. I thought someone finally did what I've been calling for and start taking credit for stuff. I loved the live cam. In fact, we've used it on the show a number of times. But can you talk a little bit about what it took to get that done and with that moving?
It was amazing. And Rick, I watched the live cam as well some evening. So I give tremendous credit to the leadership of Governor Shapiro to create the direction, create the demand, and get everybody organized in the same direction and do it quickly. I also want to really put a shout out to the union workers in the building trades who were the ones to execute it, to get the work done. Without the building trades, it would not have been done so quickly. You needed those individuals to be willing to work 24/7. That's also what it took. But I give Governor Shapiro a tremendous amount of credit to get that temporary road up. It is used for Philadelphia, but not just Philadelphia. The whole Northeast Corridor, trucks were being delayed, deliveries were being delayed. And so it was very important for our overall economy to get that road up again. And you really got to give him a lot of credit. I said to my wife, John Shapiro is now America's governor, having gotten I-95 back on track so quickly.
No. What this shows me, and again, I've been talking about this, since the reopening, it shows that we can do big things. When we take off the red hat and the blue hat and we get a hard hat on, we can accomplish good things. And this just shows that when we put some of this nonsense aside, we can do good things.
I think it will help us raise our aspirations in terms of what we can be in the Commonwealth, what we can be as a nation, and who we can really be. And raising our aspirations, I think, will go a long way in dealing with the prior conversation you had about the status of the former president. Once we can really see that we can be much better than what some of this leadership is selling us, then I think that can help us get beyond those who are trying to drag all of us into the gutter.
I'm right there with you. Senator Haywood, I appreciate your time. Keep up the great work in the Senate, and let's get that minimum wage done. I hope folks will reach out to your office and to others to push in the right direction. If you want to see the minimum wage increased, call your state senator in Pennsylvania and tell them, hey, we need to do this. But, Art, I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Rick, and thanks for your encouragement.
Good stuff, our good friend Art Haywood. Look, at the end of the day, you want something done, call these people early, call them often, and tell them it's time. Now, do it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1993. That was the day that A.E. Staley locked out 763 workers at their corn processing plant in Decatur, Illinois. Labor management relations grew increasingly hostile with foreign-owned Tate Lyle's decision to bring in new managers. The new management ordered workers to disregard safety regulations. An OSHA investigation found an astonishing 298 violations at the plant, triggering more than $1.5 million in fines. Despite the fines, worker safety concerns persisted. Management proposed a new contract designed to destroy grievance rights, seniority, and worker safety. Even worse, workers would be required to work 12-hour shifts. They would have to be available both night and day shifts at management's whim. 96% of the workers voted to reject the contract. In response, the company locked the workers out of the plant. The locked-out workers were replaced with scabs. As the lockout wore on month after month, and in the face of the employer's refusal to negotiate, the workers had to rely on one another to stay strong. They went door-to-door throughout Decatur to inform the public about what was happening. In 1994 and 1995, the workers were joined on the picket lines by United Auto Workers from the city's Caterpillar plant and rubber workers from Bridgestone Firestone. Those workers had gone out on strike as their employers took extreme hardline bargaining positions, earning Decatur the nickname of Strike City. The eyes of the nation were on Central Illinois. It seemed that the Decatur struggle was the stage for the modern labor movement. Workers were fighting back in the age of international mergers and all-out attacks on union workers. 3 days before Christmas in 1995, however, the National Union settled the strike, leaving many of the workers angry with the settlement that took their voice away. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something in your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Rick Scott, Skeletor, Florida senator, evidently doesn't want socialists or communists coming to Florida. He warned that socialists and communists not to travel to Florida. They're not welcome. Okay. How about people who steal from Medicare? Yeah, how about people who... how about them? Oh, yeah, that's you. Never mind. Speaking of Florida, a woman who really was guilty on the face, because she was one of the January 6th people. On social media, she put out, "We breached the Capitol, OMG." Said, "Insurrection is coming. Hold the line. Stay vigilant. Storming the Capitol to take back our country from traitors." She put all this stuff on social media. Now, remember, on the 6th, when all this happened, I remember going on air saying it's going to be interesting to watch all these people who are going to have to go to trial with all of the treason that they recorded. Because these are people who for weeks, days, months were talking about this stuff and were very proud of their treason. And promoted the fact, like on Parler and other right wing sites, she pled guilty to what she was already guilty of, a felony charge of civil disorder. We'll see what she gets. I'm sure it's not going to be really long because she only spent, I guess, like 10 minutes in the Capitol. But the fact that she went in with the idea that this is an insurrection. It's the mindset that, yes, we're invading the Capitol. And as I said from the beginning, all of those people knew why they were there. Everyone who went to Washington, D.C. on that day went for the express purpose of stopping the certification of the election. It was in the title. It was Stop the Steal. They believed that they had been cheated. They believed what Trump had told them, that everything was rigged. They bought it. They went believing that they were patriots and they were going to water that tree of liberty with the blood of tyrants and patriots. And their mindset was, we're going to stop the election. We're going to stop the certification of this election, even if it means hanging Mike Pence, to which someone did actually build a gallows. You cannot now say, well, we were just walking through the ropes and it was like an ordinary. Nope. For me, you went there with the intent, and this is what happens to traitors. This is what happens. You went there knowing what you were doing. You bought all in. You thought your guy was going to be behind you, and your guy screwed you. And the thing that gets me, and it's just mind-blowing, is that they're going through all this stuff, and their guy has done virtually nothing for them. It's quite remarkable. Speaking of the guy... you may remember a guy named Stephen Miller, Trump's top immigration advisor. Well, the big story today that came out is evidently Stephen Miller, who some have akin to Goebbels or some of the Nazi elite. I'm not going there. But, I got to be honest. The fact that he was it's being reported that he wanted to, I don't know how you do this. I actually don't. But evidently he was pushing Trump to attack the migrants coming into the country using drones. Literally, you know, using drones. And he wanted to blow up boats full of unarmed civilians who were coming with predator drones. And these, again, these are the very best people. Remember, Trump is only going to surround himself with the very best people. So this idea that, yeah, okay, there's a ship of migrants coming towards the U.S., bomb them. If that comes into your head, if that's a thought, you're a horrible person. There's just no other way of putting that. Look, if you say, yeah, well, we'll capture them, you know, we'll put them on a boat and send them back, put them on a plane and send them back. If, you know, that, okay, you can think that, but bomb them? Let them drown in the ocean at your hand? I mean, it's bad enough if you let them, if the boat sinks and you do nothing to help them. That's horrible as well. But the idea that actively gonna bomb them? And it's one of those stories that I read and I'm going, you know, I'm actually not surprised. I'm actually not shocked anymore. And that's one of the things that I guess I'm attempting to deal with, that my level of shock is way out of whack. My level of expectations of others and their humanity is kind of out of whack. And I got to deal with that because there are people. And as I say about my Republican friends who want to do this kind of stuff, the cruelty really is the point. You know, they believe that their immigration policy should be, you know, if we bomb one of them, nobody else will come. We'll send that message. And they justify it in their head. Yeah, we'll take out a couple hundred of them and we'll let them all drown and we'll record it and we'll put it out as a warning to others. Yeah, that's that. And the weird thing is, and I come back to the cruelty being the point, that's something that the base, the Red Hat Brigade, all behind. And I got, again, it speaks volumes to who they are, especially the ones that you know wear the cross around their neck. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Does that surprise you? Shock? Not really. Anyway, if you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.